Well, thanks again, team, for leading us. And again, as we sing those songs, boy, oh boy, if you believe that stuff, it'll really change you, won't it? It'll change you. And we hope you believe that stuff. It's transforming. Well, I'm here to talk about fire. Any fires burning this morning? That's bad English, this morning. Imagine if we were a church in California. Terrible, isn't it? Fire. The other day I was sitting on my couch, and just to the right on the TV, this flat screen plasma TV, there was fire, the fires of California, destroying dreams and houses and highways and towns and trees and wildlife, everything being consumed by the hot fires of California. And then to my left was my fireplace. I had intentionally set that fire, and it was slowly catching, and before long it was roaring in the fireplace. And as I sat there, it wasn't like I was looking for a good sermon illustration, but I did think to myself, now, this is a real contrast in terms of what's happening right here. Struck with the contrast. Because inside the fireplace, it was beautiful, warming, crackling, atmosphere enhancing, and outside the fireplace, as I looked at it on the screen, it was deadly and costly and consuming and raging and destroying. We would all agree, would we not? We would all agree that fire is beautiful, kept within bounds. But lose control and you can really do a lot of damage. Now, just before I proceed, is there any way of getting that screen on the wall right in front of me turned on? Anyway, it's just a question, but I'll keep going. But here's the question. You don't need to show your hands up, but how many would agree that sex? Yes, I said sex. Sex can be like fire. And if it's not boundaried, it can be very damaging. In fact, the contrast I would say is that some of you this morning would say sex can be wonderful. But for a new word that I've coined here, it can be wonderful. And some of us would have different perspectives on that. Our text this morning is Proverbs chapter 5. It's a series, it's the last message in this series, me, myself, and my ... based on the book of Proverbs. And this morning as we come to the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 5, so take your Bible and turn there, please. It answers a simple question, where should the fire burn? But the more profound question, the question that we really want to drill down on for a few moments is, what's the nature of this fire? And so if you take your Bible and you open it, or your iPad and you open it, your phone, and you just look at the whole chapter, if your screen allows you to do that, you kind of get an aerial shot of Proverbs chapter 5, and you can see the contrast of wonderful or wonderful. You can see the contrast of the fires of California, according to the writer, and the fireplace. And so if you look at verse 1 to 14, and then you just move down to verse 20 to 23, those are the wildfires of California. This is wonderful, according to the author. And then it's almost like it's intentionally inserted here, and I'm sure it is, right into the Proverbs chapter 5, verse 15 to 19. There's the fireplace. And there's what is, according to the writer, there is what is delicious and powerful and amazing, and as opposed to the wildfires of California. So as we have seen over the last several weeks, Proverbs is a book about wisdom, ultimately found in the fear of the Lord. Proverbs chapter 5 and many other chapters in the book of Proverbs address this issue of fire and apply wisdom to this issue of fire. And so this morning we want to take the majority of our time and spend it in the fireplace, verse 15 to 19, not the wildfires of the state of California. And as we do that, I realize that there are some real challenges as we talk about this. For example, not everybody here this morning is convinced that fire should stay in the fireplace, right? We need to understand the tension. For example, the gospel calls us into both form and freedom. Gospel is a word that refers to the good news in the broadest sense and culminating at the cross, but it's good news. And so the gospel calls us to this idea of form, that there needs to be boundary and there needs to be rules. There needs to be truths that kind of guide. And also the gospel talks about freedom. And so when it comes to this issue of fire, some people like just to talk about the rules and the boundaries, and other people, maybe the more progressive people, love freedom and openness and choices, especially when it comes to sex. And so some people will look at Proverbs chapter 5 and say, this is very Victorian. This is very prudish. This is very straight-laced. Time has passed. It's impossible to follow Proverbs chapter 5. And whatever camp you're in, both see part of the truth, because the gospel calls us to the whole truth. And the truth is that God gave us our sexuality both to focus our romantic joy. There's the form to focus our romantic joy and to unleash our romantic joy. There's the freedom. And when this very human joy is both focused and unleashed, having both form and freedom, or structure and liberation, it becomes wonderfully intensified. Proverbs chapter 5 says, keep the fire in the fireplace and stoke that fire as hot as you can. Proverbs chapter 5 does not say that a marriage is always this sexual mountain peak. It looks at an aspect of marriage. So for those of you that have that question, no, this is an aspect. This is a chapter of many chapters in a marriage, or a face of many faces of a marriage, a fireplace. The other thing I would say is that in Proverbs chapter 5, both the man and the woman have been singed. Both the man and the woman are broken. Both the man and the woman have problems with fire. And so we need to understand that as well. I realize that as I talk about this morning, some of you are deeply wounded. You wouldn't say wonderful, you would say wonderful, right? Some of you are thinking about taking the fire outside the fireplace. I realize that. Some of you are saying, I just think I can't keep this prudish Victorian way of doing fire. And it could come in all different expressions: pornography, self-pleasure, extramarital affairs, sexting, feeding your mind on images that come through media that fuel the unhealthy fires of California. Some of you are thinking, how do I get the fire back in the fireplace? You know, it's hard. And some of you are thinking, Kachapa, who do you think you are? You 56-year-old, middle white-aged, you know, male? You've had your fireplace burning for 35 years. It's easy for you to have a talk about like this, but you don't understand my situation. I get that. I completely understand that. I realize also, as we talk about this, that the church has not always got it right, has it? There is a group of people called the ascetics. Those are basically ascetics, or people that don't shop at Costco. And in church history, that's for you guys. And in church history, they would sometimes, the ascetics would get married, but they would abstain from sex because they thought that this was some form of a higher spirituality. That's weird, right? Others, including the church father, Origen, and other church fathers, attempting to obey Christ, would emasculate themselves so not to lust, so not to commit adultery or fornication. Some literally beat their bodies. Others spent most of their lives atop towers, seeking to avoid the world's defilements, not just fire, but other kinds of temptations. So there have been all kinds of things that have been done, and not so great, not so wise, not so biblical. This morning, as we come to this text, I'm not going to try to prove a point. I'm not proving a point this morning. But I'm simply wanting to present the gospel, good news, invitation for you to consider where this fire should burn. To consider this, because I know a lot of you are wondering, is this antiquated? Is this Victorian? Is this prudish? Is this straight-laced? Is this something of our past? Do we need to find greater freedom? If you're a disciple of Christ, this is a discipleship issue. This is a lordship issue. And perhaps as we conclude, you may be able to answer the question, does this gospel offer a better path? Does this gospel, the good news, offer a better path? So where should the fire burn? Well, the text is pretty straightforward. It needs to stay within the fireplace. That's an easy question to answer. But what is the nature of this fire? I'm going to give you two answers to that question, but let's read the text. Let's jump into the fireplace. Verse 15 to 19 And here we go. Drink water from your own cistern, flowing water from your own well. Should your springs be scattered abroad, streams of water in the streets? Let them be for yourself alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. A lovely deer, a graceful doe, let her breast fill you all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love. Hot, right? It's pretty hot fire right now, right? This is a sermon that as I wrote it, I thought, man, I can't say half the things that I'd love to say. I'd lose my job, but anyways. So I got wise counsel from my wife on this. So what is the nature of this fire? And the question is, what is the nature? And so two answers. First is, notice here that this is a sacred fire. Now, I know all of you don't, but some of you do, and some people in our world do, and some people in our world don't. Some people would equate sex, and I'm using that term very broadly here, but sex is no different than a handshake. Sex is no different than like a benefit between two products of the pond, right? Scripture teaches, though, that sex is not a handshake, but something that is holy and to be revered. Sex is not about two evolutionary animals coming together, but two sacred people coming together in the fireplace. So a biblical view of what's going on in this fire is that it's a sacred fire. And so let's ask the question, well, who is in the fire? Well, there's a man and a woman in the fireplace, verse 15 to 19. And so let's ask the question. I want you to notice the sacredness of the man and notice the sacredness of the woman. Notice this man. We ask, well, who is this guy? Well, we read context. And if you go to verse 1, my son, be attentive to my wisdom. Ah, it's a son. And so if you've been with us over the last several weeks, you'll know that it's who? It's Solomon. Solomon wrote a lot, most of the Proverbs. This is Solomon. This is the son of Solomon. Solomon is a powerful, most powerful at the time, apparently the wisest, didn't always practice it. He's the wealthiest man of all time. And as he is writing, it's written to his son, or also sons, plural. And it's also written to those that are foolish and wise and immature. We know that from Proverbs chapter 1. But it's also being addressed to his sons. This is the most powerful man in the world. Who is this in the fire? This is the king. This is the son of a king. That's who's in this fire. And this father feels that he has the right to instruct his son because this is his son. And so he says, my son, be attentive to my wisdom, incline your ear to my understanding, that you may keep discretion and your lips may guard knowledge. And then he says, for the lips of a forbidden woman drip honey and her speech is smoother than oil. There's a broken woman in this chapter and there's a very broken man in this chapter. In verse 7, and now, O son, listen to me and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Keep your path far from her. And you could flip this depending on the application, and it's being addressed to the son, but it could be addressed to a woman and say, keep your path far from him. It's just that it's a letter to the son. You know what's really interesting about this, I think this is just, really interesting, is that just because you're the son of a king and can trace your gene pool to royal blood doesn't mean you'll always live like it. Would you not agree that to be true? Just because you can trace your gene pool to a king doesn't mean you always will live like the son of a king. It's interesting in this chapter, if you look at verse 13, Solomon writes, he's anticipating or perhaps speaking into the rebellious heart of his son. When he says, I did not listen to the voice of my teachers, don't be like that, he's saying. Teachers in Proverbs are men and women, your mother. Verse 12, and you say, how I hated discipline and my heart despised reproof. There's a pushback. And Solomon is writing this, and here's what I find is interesting. He's the son of a king as well. His father was David. And he knew all too well about hating discipline and wisdom. And so perhaps when Solomon is writing this, perhaps Solomon is saying, do as I say, but don't do as I do. Because a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how the guy that wrote it broke it. right? The guy that wrote these proverbs broke so many of them, especially in the world of his sexual disciplines. And in fact, perhaps he's drawing on his own journals when he says in verse 11, and he says, "And at the end of your life, you groan when your flesh and body are consumed." Is he saying that from a textbook that he's read, or is that the path that he has walked? If you know Solomon, verse 23, he dies for a lack of discipline, and because of his great folly, he is led astray. I think that Solomon is writing this letter out of his own sexual brokenness to the son of a king who has a track record, perhaps, of sexual brokenness. And so you've got a son who has probably got sexual brokenness in his life. Solomon is calling him back. But then Solomon has a backstory full of sexual brokenness. And then David, his father, has a story, I think we know about David, of sexual brokenness. And Saul, and you could go back in all of the genealogy just like you could with you and me. A backstory filled with sexual brokenness. When was the last time a father or a mother sat down with their son or their daughter and had that sex talk, talked about sexuality, and the father had no burn marks by mishandling fire? I won't ask for a show of hands, but hey, if you're a father here and you have a perfect backstory when it comes to sexuality, no, you've never been burned, you've never mishandled fire, how many would raise their hands? How many mothers would raise their hands? We talk to our children, we have a backstory of sexual brokenness, and we talk to our children who, we've had this conversation, right, where some of our kids have already been burned and we're coming to them too late, perhaps, or reactive versus proactive, sexual brokenness everywhere. What's in this fire is sacred, but it's also sinful and complex. Notice not only the sacredness of the man, notice the sacredness of the woman, and we realize the sacredness of the woman in a different way. This man is sacred or special, unique, because he's the son of a king. But the woman is special. Verse 18, notice it says here, "Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth." Rejoice. What does that mean? It means to be over the top. It means to come into the room. And imagine if my wife was to come into the room, and every time she came in the room, I'd say, "Honey, you are awesome. You should stay here for the second service too. You are, because who am I going to look at? You are incredible. You are my priority. You are everything I think about, everything I dream about." What would be her response? "Are you drunk?" No. No. As one husband said to me the other day, who started doing this, started treating his wife as he should, he said, "You should have seen it, Mark, her response. Golden. It was golden." Perhaps if that was the case of rejoicing in the wife of your youth, perhaps there's this sense of, I feel like the daughter of a king, and I'm being treated. Perhaps that person would feel honored and valued and precious and treasured. How does the wife feel when she knows that his fire is for her alone? How does she feel when she knows that her man, while tempted and tried, is faithful and true to her alone? What does that do to her? Honors her, values her, treasures her. A word I heard a wife say this week, "I feel safe." The man is using his power in this relationship to treasure her, not trash her, and to reinforce her infinite value. What do the wildfires of California do to her sense of value and identity and preciousness? I don't need to prove anything here, do I? I don't need to show any statistics. I don't need to tell any stories. You know. In fact, if you're the father of a daughter, what do you think? If you're a mom with a daughter, what do you think? What kind of guy do you want your daughter to marry? What kind of man do you want your son to grow up to be? Notice the sacredness, the specialness, the treasured nature, the value, the infinite value of this woman. Sacredness, and yet broken. Because perhaps the woman in the fireplace is the woman in the wildfires of California. And she has a sexual past, just like the man. There was a conversation that occurred once between a father and his children. And you know what was unique about that conversation? There was no sexual brokenness. Not on the part of the kids, not on the part of the father. And how do I know that? Well, the backdrop verse on the screen. So God created God, the Father, in his own image. In the image of God, he created a male and female. He created them, humanity, our image bearers of the King. There's a father talking to his kids, and they bear the image of the King, the man and the woman. Humanity, our image bearers. Human sacredness leads us to see why human sexuality is sacred and worth protecting. And when that union comes together and produces a child, that is a child that bears divine fingerprints. The sacredness. It's an interesting verse in verse 21. If you look at that, it says, For a man's ways are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. The eyes of the Lord are on the man. In this context, you think, why are they on the man? I think because this is the imagery of like a father. This is a son. This is a person who is bearing, yes, broken and scarred, but this is a person who is in some sense is sacred because of the image that they bear. And my eyes are on you because I want to see, I want you to walk in a path that is worthy of being an image bearer. There's a sacredness to who you are. So I think God's eyes are on the son because of that. But I think God's eyes are on the son because God also cares about how his daughters are treated. And he wants to see how his sons are treating his daughters. Well, what is the nature of the fire? Biblical view, you may reject it, you may accept it, but there's a sacredness to it. There's a sacredness to this fire. The second thing, and my last point, is that it's an intimate fire. Human sexuality, human contact, sexual contact is about knowing another person. It's about knowledge, knowing. Human sexuality, biblical view, is about cultivating a profound intimacy where trust and safety are foundational. That can be countercultural for some in our culture and for some in the church, but not all. Is the fire in the fireplace in this context always intimate? If you've been listening, you'd say, no, I don't think it is. Why? Because yes, there are two individuals that are sacred, but they're broken. And so sometimes what hinders that profound intimacy is brokenness getting in the way because both probably come to the fireplace with a sexual past. And that can hinder intimacy. And so both have to decide to take their wounds and move closer together versus take their wounds and sleep in opposite beds. There's an intimacy here. And before we jump into the text briefly, I want you to notice that before time began and when time ends, time in a biblical sense, the biblical narrative is bookended by marriage. And marriage has always been about intimacy. In Genesis chapter 2 on the screen, therefore a man will leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they will become one flesh. That word one flesh does not mean one. One. It doesn't mean one. It means unified. It means bringing two sacred people together with distinct personalities. And it literally in the Hebrew means glue. and gluing them together, not one, but unified, and experiencing an intimacy that is both physical and spiritual and emotional. There's profound intimacy. So from the very beginning of time, marriage was always about intimacy and cultivating intimacy. And then you come to the end of time, as you see in Revelation 22, it says the Spirit and the bride. And who's the bride? The church. The church. And the church says, come. And let the one who says, come to the groom who is Christ. And let the one who is thirsty come. Let the one who desires take the water of life without price. Notice here, our ultimate thirst is not satisfied in our brides and our grooms or our friends. Ultimate thirst is satisfied in the groom, in Christ. Ultimate thirst will be satisfied when we stand in his presence. But whether you look at the beginning of time or the end of time, marriage is a place of intimacy. Verse 4 in that chapter, Revelation says, we shall see his face. There is profound intimacy. Marriage is about connectedness. Now, my guess, if you're not married, and perhaps one day you will be, or perhaps you won't be, that's fine. But if you perhaps will one day be married, you would want to marry someone who's willing and eager to work on those deep connections. Probably. My other guess is that if you are married, intimacy is something that you have to constantly work on. My guess is you have intimacy challenges. I bet. Because I do. I have to work at it. I have to work at that. Pursuing each other, treasuring each other, engaging with each other. Intimacy. But marriage is about intimacy. One of the things, it's intimacy on every level. One writer says this when he talks about our desire for connectedness. He says, we're hardwired for emotional connection to other people. We want to be known. We crave being loved. We want to be accepted by someone who is completely aware of our gifts and our flaws and yet wants to be with us anyways. In short, we crave intimacy. And then he writes, on a little study table in my office, there's a card with a quote from Victor Hugo. It says this, my coat and I live comfortably together. It has assumed all my wrinkles, does not hurt me anywhere, has molded itself on my deformities and is complacent to all my movements, and I only feel its presence because it keeps me warm. Old coats are old friends. And then he writes this, on the back of the card written in pen are four words, you are my coat, and it is signed by his wife. Then he writes, that's intimacy. And then he writes this, you may be thinking Nancy, his wife, must be a wonderful person to be married to. He says, she is, sometimes. Because she's sacred, but broken. Notice quickly two things about intimacy. There's so much that could be said here, but notice intimacy that is built upon exclusivity. Notice here in verse 16, should your springs be scattered abroad, streams of water in the streets? There's some great, powerful imagery. Talk about that in your life group. And this is the wildfires of California here, verse 16. But notice the contrast in verse 15. Drink water from your own cistern. Notice the metaphor, the imagery here. Your own cistern. Don't go at everybody else's wells, which was a problem in Israel when it came to farming and agricultural societies. You'd steal water from other people's wells. So he's using an analogy, an illustration here that makes a whole lot of sense. Flowing water from your own well. Verse 17, let them be for yourself alone. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breast fill you at all times with delight and be intoxicated always in her love. This is erotic language. Bible's relevant. It's exclusive language. And it's language that speaks of a well-worn path establishing deep, deep levels of intimacy that go far beyond just the physical. And when he refers to the term wife in the Hebrew and in the culture, it was a term that referenced a covenant relationship. Now, a whole message could be preached on covenant. But suffice to say that marriage itself is a covenant relationship promised horizontally to each other and promise to God. And it's a covenant, kind of, but not exactly like a contract, but where there are promises and obligations that are being stated between the two. And on this next slide, the biblical view of marriage is that there is both feeling and duty, passion and promise. That is because at the heart of the biblical idea of marriage is the covenant. And so covenant realizes there's going to be times in your life, Proverbs chapter 5, where there's all kinds of feeling and there's all kinds of passion. That's wonderful. But it's not always going to be like that. And sometimes there's duty. And sometimes there is promise. And it's this combination of feeling and duty, passion and promise. And we don't have time to go into it, but the contrast between the wildfires of California and the fire in the fireplace is consumerism versus covenant. Consumerism says, I'm here until my needs are no longer met, and then I'm out. Covenant says, I am not actually here for my own needs. Purely, I am submitting myself to the greater needs of this relationship, and it turns everything on its head. Covenant. And to say this, that covenant is the idea, there are these two sacred people, biblical view here, two sacred people who are very vulnerable and very broken and who have backstory that make things complicated, but they're coming together and they're playing with fire. And I mean that in a good sense. Fire that can be explosive and destructive, and fire that can be wonderful or wonderful. And so covenant is the idea that this is so important that we want both in this relationship to understand the commitment that goes way beyond feeling and passion to obligation and promise. And we're going to build a fence around this and hold it up as a witness before men and God. And it's a stamp of the sacredness of it and how the intimacy of that needs to be protected. Just to comment, the problem today is, just speaking about the church, is where some of you would say this morning, well, I'm not into the wildfires of California. I don't do that. But you would say also, but I'm not in a covenant relationship either. But I sleep with my boyfriend, I sleep with my girlfriend, or other forms, other expressions, self-pleasure, pornography, you name it. And so we develop this continuum, and we kind of develop a way that kind of justifies our narrative. Now, I'm just saying to you, you may not like this, because this isn't always easy, right? But the biblical understanding, this is a sacred relationship between two sacred people experiencing profound intimacy where covenant is to be established that is part of the protection of that relationship and helping people understand the obligation and the promises being made, and sexual expression happens within side of a covenant. It's kind of simple. It's like either you're in the sandbox playing with your toys or you're outside of the sandbox playing with your toys. That's not in my notes. You may not like that. This is hard stuff. So intimacy is built on exclusivity and a well-worn path as the husband and the wife come together on all kinds of levels, physical, spiritual, emotional, repeatedly drilling down, developing the depth of that relationship. And as someone said to me, what's better than young love? Old love. Nothing wrong with young love, but old love, well-worn path, learning, fumbling, holding each other accountable, forgiving, being gracious, pursuing, saying I'm sorry. That's old love, and it's wonderful. Intimacy is built on exclusivity. Finally here, and this is not a politically correct statement, but it's kingdom correct. Intimacy because of diversity. Interesting in our culture, when it comes to disparities between the sexes, We use it as a form of humor, and I think it's great, because men are very different than women. They're not better, just different, right? But it can be the fodder for Shakespearean plays or romance novels or sitcoms. But just want you to note here, the biblical understanding here is it's actually diversity in the fireplace that cultivates deep intimacy. Like two people speaking different languages but wanting to know each other, they have to learn each other's languages or language. They have to really work at pursuing and engaging. It's the diversity that invites the work of intimacy. Can I just say that again? The biblical understanding, it is the diversity. It is the diversity that invites the work and demands the work of intimacy. And you see that in this text. Just really quickly, right? Verse 15, drink water from your own cistern. We know that that's not referring to, I need H2O, I need to go find a well. This is a sexual metaphor. The man has a thirst, he goes to something very different. A well is very different than a man. He's going to something that is very different. But we know that in this book, it's not water and it's not a well, it's a man and his hunger and his thirst for connecting and for intimacy and vulnerability. And the cistern is a woman. Now that's radical. It's kingdom correct. It's not politically correct, and that's okay. And then notice the differences here. She's a lovely deer and a graceful doe. I'm not going to go into all this, but he's not. As one guy said, I hunt deer, but that's a different illustration. Yeah. Let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. She has breasts. He doesn't have breasts, right? And you're thinking, oh my goodness, I can't believe he said that. We're almost done here. Be intoxicated by her love. Intoxication is this idea of being drunk and being caught up, being captured, inability to walk. This is intoxication. This person that is so different than me, but it begs the pursuit and development of this profound intimacy. And what is also interesting is that in verse 20, the word intoxicated is used as well, having to do with the wildfires of California. And what does that mean? Well, the Bible is clear. Sex, or sex is pleasurable, yes. Sin is pleasurable. If you are consuming the wildfires of California or outside of the boundaries of God, you are having a great time. I'm sure of it. Perhaps, probably. It can be intoxicating. But the biblical narrative is that there can be an intoxication within the fireplace that leads to deeper, more profound relationship in the covenant context, or there can be intoxication that leads to complication. And that's the contrast that the scripture lays. So where is this fire? Biblically, it's supposed to stay in the fireplace. Is that easy? No. Whether you're married or not, it's not always easy. You have to deal with that. What's the nature of this fire? From a biblical perspective, there's a sacredness. There's a sacredness to this fire. This is a son of a king. In the spiritual sense, this is the daughter of a king. An intrinsic value. And this is a intimate fire that is rooted on exclusivity and is profoundly connected and described here that there's this diversity that brings these two people together in the context of covenant. And so as we close, does the gospel offer a better path? Some of you might say, I don't think so. That's where you're at. But if you're married, here's a question. Is it worth working for? This intimacy and wonder doesn't just fall into your lap. It takes work. And sometimes the wood is wet and you get a lot of smoke, not fire. And it's not all sexual, is it? It takes a lot of work. And so if you're married, is this worth working for? And some questions to get you going on this for married people is, are you treating your wife like the daughter of a king? And wives, are you treating your husbands like the sons of a king? Just talk about that this afternoon. We as men don't always do well here. I'll speak on the men's part here. If you're single, here's the question. Is this worth waiting for? I'm not going to ask for show of hands here, but you know, is this worth waiting for? Does the gospel offer a better path? You may wonder where that other sacred individual is, by the way. Where is that man or woman who loves Jesus? Where is that man that will treat me like the daughter of a king? Where is the woman that will treat me like the son of a king? Who would be willing to make that promise? Let me say to you, if you're single and you're debating, is this worth waiting for? Let me just say, you need to be part of community in the wait. So to talk and walk this out. As you seek this kind of intimacy in marriage, seek intimacy in community first. And sometimes in waiting, we wonder, we wander, and we worry. We need community. You need community to help you process. And not a community just with single people talking about, where's Mr. Right? Where's Mrs. Right? And not that everyone wants to get married, but in that context, are you willing to wait for it if that's your ambition? You need a community. And the final is, if you've been burned by the wildfires of California, is it worth wrestling through towards healing? Does God see me as worthy and redeemable? I know that there's lots of people out here. You'd say, sex is wonderful. Wonderful. I'm hurt. I don't know if I can trust again. And I get that. And I wonder if Proverbs chapter 5 is really a chapter about redemption. I don't know all the background, but I do wonder, has this man that's in the fireplace where the father is writing, has he been in the wildfires of California? And now is he coming back in? An invitation, as bizarre as it may sound, by his father, who has a sexual past that rivals, is rivaled by none. And this woman, I wonder if perhaps, as we develop that narrative, could have she been the woman in the wildfires of California? She was a wife in the wildfires of California, depicted as the wife being unfaithful. This is a chapter, I think, that talks about redemption. Doesn't matter, regardless of what your sexual background is, nothing disqualifies you from God's redemptive purposes. So let's pray. Father, for all of us, maybe not all of us, for a lot of us, this is one of the most difficult, challenging issues we deal with as Christ followers. And so, Lord, I would pray for all those that are here this morning that are Christ followers, that in a married relationship, perhaps single, would you speak into our hearts, their hearts, and allow the truth of this text to bring health and wholeness and healing, and perhaps really healthy dialogue in communities as we want to be people that are healthy and whole in this area that there's so much pain in, so much complication, so much complexity. And Lord, for those that are really asking the question, does the gospel offer a better path? Lord, would you speak into their hearts on this very, very important issue? Lead us to be more like you. And help us to realize that our ultimate thirst will never be satisfied in our husband or our wife or a really good friend or our jobs. Our ultimate thirst will be truly satisfied in the one who is the centerpiece of this gospel, the groom that we, the church, the bride, wait for. So come, Lord, and do your work in our hearts. And just as we pause now, we're going to sing one song that is a song of kind of commitment and dedication, and perhaps you'll be able to sing it, perhaps you won't be able to sing it, perhaps you just listen to it. So we may have some people here singing it, some people just listening. Let's stand as we respond with one song.